back to another episode of Ruby for All. It's been a while, but we are back. Julie, what is up?
I've got a couple things to say. One is, Andrew might sound a little bit different because his microphone doesn't work and we spent about 20 minutes trying to fix it.
I'm tilted.
It's using a backup mic. So I'm in California and I went skiing last week and there was a huge storm. You may have heard it in the news, maybe not. But we had to shorten our trip by a day so we can avoid the storm. We left Thursday morning to go back home and we ended up having to put chains on because a storm was coming on Donner Pass is where a lot of folks are actually stranded. But after we put our chains on, after a while of driving, we hear this clanking sound and we're like, uh-oh, what's that? My husband goes out to go see our chain broke. Luckily though, the chain broke and just half a mile up ahead, you could take your chains off. So we got super lucky and we got out of the storm. Anyways, there's like hundreds of people stranded on the same spot that we had driven to. And we're just lucky that we got out of it.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. How was skiing?
It was great. I skied 3 days and I was super sore afterwards. My body's not built like it was before. And so I'm happily resting now.
I think my exact words, you were like, go send it over like a thing. When you were telling me about your trip, I was like, dude, you got to do something sick. But yeah. Any bad falls?
No, luckily not.
There you go. See, she's an expert.
No, it's because I was too, what's the word? The opposite of brave.
Timid.
Oh my gosh. We went down this area that we weren't familiar with and we looked at this map and it showed us, okay, there's some blue squares like intermediate. There's a blue square where we can go back to this other lift. There's no way to get over there. On the map on the seat, it showed us something different than what actually would happen. So me, my 6-year-old and my 8-year-old went down to the Black Diamonds and my 6-year-old was able to get down it, but took quite a long time and he's not used to Black Diamonds, but that was like probably the most eventful thing.
Nice.
Out of that.
That's fun. Well, so anything else happened on our little sabbatical that we took accidentally?
Right. Yeah. It's been a few weeks, huh? No, nothing really. How about you?
I went through some pretty bad burnout and I see the light at the end of the tunnel finally. So yeah, I think maybe we'll get back to doing this regularly. Hopefully we'll see. It's been a busy, busy, busy time of year. But today on the show, we have Ryan Caldwell. Ryan, thank you for coming. You introduce yourself to the folks who may not know you and your awesome adventures.
Hi, yeah. So I'm Ryan. I'm a software engineer 3 at GitHub. I'm currently working on the Copilot product. And specifically, I'm working on Copilot chat. There's a number of different facets to Copilot, but my team kind of owns everything chat related.
Nice.
So yeah.
So inline chat and the chat sidebar stuff.
Yep. Exactly.
Cool. What else are you known for?
Am I known for? Probably nothing.
Dude, you're known for things. You're not a speaker, right? We haven't met each other at a conference, have we?
No, we haven't. I think that we've mostly just kind of interacted over Twitter and stuff. And then we played Call of Duty together once.
That's like, right. Okay. I was like, I feel like I've known Ryan forever. Like we're friends. Yeah. Like where from? Yeah. We did play Call of Duty together.
Yeah.
That's right.
No, if we get to meet at a conference, that would be awesome. But yeah, it's just Call of Duty and Twitter for now.
There you go. The two sanctuaries on this planet, Call of Duty and Twitter. So you're working on Copilot. What language are you writing in a lot these days?
On Copilot for my team specifically, it's mostly just a Go REST API, and it's a pretty reasonably sized project, I guess. Like, it's not a huge code base. I think that there's lots of other projects inside of GitHub that are really, really, really big. And that's not to say that Copilot isn't. It definitely is. But the service that my team has ownership over is pretty manageable size right now. There's definitely differing layers of complexity, but I only joined my team in Copilot a few months ago. It was in the latter half of last year after I got back from paternity leave. I moved over from Codespaces prior to that. But yeah, it's been great so far. And I love my team and I love the product. And it's been a lot of fun. It's been a learning experience. Yeah, lots of Go.
Why was Go the right choice for that project?
Yeah, I think that it's definitely been helpful so far. I think that a large percentage of the people that started my project and team that I'm on had prior experience in Go and prior experience in Go on Copilot specifically. So I think that there's definitely a facet of this is what we're already using. This is what people are familiar with. And that's what we're going to start the new project with. That did happen before I joined the team. I joined the team maybe in September or something like that, August, September, somewhere around that time. And the project really started spinning up in February, I think. So yeah, I think that it definitely has been good so far. I think that the idea that Go is really simple to read and like there aren't too many crazy constructs that you kind of have to wrap your head around as a language has been helpful. I didn't have a ton of experience with Go before I joined my team, and I found it like reasonably straightforward to pick up. I definitely think that there are different parts that can be pretty confusing, or at least they're confusing to me. But in terms of getting productive and starting to ship things, I feel like you're able to do it pretty quickly.
I've written some Go. I enjoyed it. I just don't understand why you didn't write in Rust, bro. No, I'm just kidding. I saw a lot of Rust tweets this week. What was your first language that you learned?
I started like getting interested in writing code in high school and kind of just went on W3 schools or whatever and just started like reading things on my own. So I was kind of just doing like the typical, oh, I learned what a loop is in JavaScript and I put 1,000 things on a screen. That's kind of how I started, was JavaScript. And then I went to Python and Java, and I stayed in Java land for a while, unfortunately. But yeah, first start was pretty much JavaScript.
So when did you learn Ruby? I assume you know Ruby.
Yeah, I do know Ruby. I wouldn't call myself the Ruby guy or something like that. I'm not working on Ruby core or anything, but I do consider myself as a person being reasonably knowledgeable in Ruby. I love it. It's my favorite language. I learned Ruby at one of my previous jobs. We had just a simple Rails server that was kind of like the whole front-end, back-end, full-stack app. And it was also serving traffic for the mobile applications that we had. It was for an insurance company. And that's kind of where I got my introduction to Ruby. I was hired to do a lot of client stuff. So like Android, and then we eventually refactored a bunch of things to a React Native app. And as soon as that started happening, I was like, Ruby sounds cool. I don't really want to write React. So yeah, I kind of made like a hard cutover and started working on the Rails app almost exclusively. And that's kind of when I found out that I was like super into Rails, both as an ideology and just in terms of me being happy writing it and being able to learn and do a lot with a pretty small amount of effort compared to what I was used to.
You've picked up a lot of languages. What's your trick to learning and getting started with a new language?
It's funny that you say that, because I feel like I've been writing Ruby almost exclusively for like the last 3 years, maybe. I feel like it's almost exclusively been Ruby. So since that job was Ruby, and then my next job was also almost exclusively Rails, and then I was hired at GitHub to work on the Codespaces team in the Monolith primarily, which is a big Rails app. So I feel like I kind of have been stuck there for a while, but not in a way that I've been wanting to move out of it. But whenever I pick up a new language, I've actually found it really hard to make a switch if I'm not working on a project where I can build onto something or start something from scratch. If I just say, oh, let's learn how to add two numbers together and go through the super basic thing, like it's not really helpful for me. The thing that's helpful for me is, let's add a feature onto an existing app or product or whatever. And having to figure out how your piece fits into the bigger picture is kind of the hard part. And then just being able to reference a bunch of code around it and say, oh, this is how we deal with whatever, is probably the way that I've found the most success in learning a new language, for sure.
What's it like going from a dynamic to a typed language?
Yeah, it's been different for sure. I haven't worked with a statically typed language for a while, really since two jobs ago when I was doing a lot of Java stuff. But yeah, it's been a pretty hard cutover from Ruby to Go over the last 6 to 8 months or whatever. And I think that there are certain niceties that exist in Rails that, or like Ruby, I guess, that I don't necessarily have in a statically typed language like Go that can make it a bit difficult to do things sometimes, or at least toy around with new ideas. So for example, one thing that I found infinitely useful about Rails specifically is just being able to hop into like a staging console or a production console and just play with data really quickly and just say like, oh, how can I deal with some complicated object? How can I pull what I need out of it? That's been super helpful playing with actual data. But when we're doing something in Go, we don't have production console where we can just hop in and like write a little bit of code and do whatever we need to do just from like an experimentation perspective. So yeah, that's kind of been one of my gripes so far. But honestly, I think that it's been a reasonably straightforward shift just because it's been not a huge cognitive load. I think that the simplicity of the language has made it pretty easy. And the fact that you get a lot of autocomplete help and stuff like that is really great. That's obviously a thing that exists in Ruby, but it's been a first-class citizen for forever with statically typed languages. And that's been probably the most helpful thing so far.
Hi there, Julie here. I would like to take a moment to thank GoRails for sponsoring this episode. When I was first starting out, I struggled with finding up-to-date content to help me level up. Then I learned about GoRails. Not only does GoRails provide new screencasts weekly, they also have two fantastic instructors that break down complex topics into digestible chunks. On top of that, I really appreciate when they explain the whys behind the subject. One of my favorite walkthroughs is creating your first Ruby gem from scratch. What a great way to learn by stripping down to just the basics. If you care about leveling up as a Ruby engineer, you can't go wrong with GoRails. Check it out at gorails.com.
Have you worked with RBS or Sorbet?
Yeah, I don't have any experience with RBS at all, actually. But with Sorbet, when I was on the Codespaces team, one of the last things that I kind of worked on was migrating the Codespaces owned part of the monolith to being 100% typed true with Sorbet. So doing that migration was a learning experience for sure. So yeah, Sorbet I've definitely had some experience with.
We talked to Ufu recently, who offered to get us a Sorbet expert. I'm curious to get your thoughts on Sorbet, like especially integrating into such a big project like GitHub. I know Shopify has done a ton of doing that in their app as well, but I'm just kind of curious what your experience with it was like, whether you enjoyed it, whether it hindered you, whether it helped.
Yeah. One of the cool things about Sorbet is that it kind of can be gradually adopted into a project. It's not really an all or nothing thing. I think that that's kind of the big win with adding any kind of static type checking to a dynamic language. So being able to just kind of toy with it and just say, you know, like, let's add it to like one small file and just see how we feel about it. And then just build on top of that from there. In terms of things that I liked and didn't like, I think that when it comes to classes that have really well-defined features or pieces of functionality or whatever, it's really helpful to say, like, it's having function signatures. That's just the big win with having really well-defined boundaries between two different pieces of code and how they interact with each other. In terms of incorporating it into things like models, I have not had the best experience. I think that it's been either user error or something that I just kind of need to get used to. One of the problems that I had incorporating it to larger active record models is the fact that you kind of have to do this clunky binding type of stuff inside of things like scopes or things like that. And it's felt a little clunky for sure, where if you just wanted to add a method signature to whatever method, it's very easy and straightforward. But for things like scopes and I think maybe even like class level functions, you have to do some weird binding type stuff.
Gotcha. Do you think it improved the quality of the code?
Yeah, it definitely found a couple of weird little edge cases or like bugs that we weren't aware of. So I guess, first of all, it's good that we didn't run into those beforehand. It's like we didn't have errors popping up or anything that would have been crazy. But if you see something like that and then you write a unit test for it, you're like, oh, this totally could be a thing that happens. And the fact that it requires you to call out a case for that or say, let's change the structure of this code a little bit so that that's not allowed to happen. That's been a really big improvement, I think.
What do you think the biggest benefit is?
The biggest benefit of sorbet, at least for me, I think that it really helps you think about the boundaries between two different pieces of code and how they interact with each other. It really makes you think about how you kind of want to configure things and what you want these contracts between classes to look like. So yeah, I think that that's kind of been the biggest win, is maybe the thought process that you're forced to go through instead of being able to just return whatever and think about the implications that it's going to have on callers of a certain method from outside of a class. If you change a function signature to return one thing instead of like a string instead of an integer, you might see a bunch of red squiggles pop up in lots of different files and you just go, oh, okay, maybe let's rethink this or something like that.
What's the biggest downside to adding it?
At least for code spaces, it took a little while. I don't know that there was a downside immediately in terms of usability or people learning about it or anything like that. But I think that since it was kind of just me and one other person that was doing the migration for an entire team, it can be a little bit confusing to go into code and just see a bunch of new stuff in files that you've worked on before and go, I'm like, what is this? I don't really understand what sorbet is. So yeah, I think that leading an adoption of sorbet into a team, you kind of have this responsibility to say, these are the resources that we have for learning this. This is why we're doing it, and really kind of communicating why it's happening and not just saying all 300 files that we own have been migrated to sorbet. Good luck. The most jarring thing is popping into a file and seeing stuff that is new and you might not really be familiar with. But from a usability perspective, I think that everybody onboarded to using it and making changes with it pretty quickly.
Looking back at your whole process here, would you do anything different? Would you still add sorbet or use it?
Yeah. So I think that it was definitely a larger effort even outside of code spaces. I think it was more of like a monolith level project that we were kind of starting to adopt sorbet inside of the GitHub monolith, which is cool. I was totally on board with it. I don't know that I would do anything too differently, except for maybe revisit estimates of how long I thought it might take. I think that there were definitely times where, you know, I'd start making changes to a file and then you run the type checker and you just go, oh my God, like, I don't understand this error. I don't know what to do with this. So I'm just going to stash my changes and come back to it in a day or so. I think that sometimes, depending on like the complexity of the code or how much support it provides to the rest of the project, it can make things difficult sometimes to like do that migration because it requires some changes to things that might not have the best test coverage or whatever. And you really have to be careful refactoring those things because of all the typical issues that come along with software development. Like, oh, somebody wrote this and they're not here anymore. And it's a little complicated. Not everybody understands it. Stuff like that. But overall, no, I don't think that I would do anything too differently aside from maybe get a better feel for how long I thought it was going to take before just starting to migrate stuff.
Would you go back to Ruby/Rails without sorbet?
Yeah, for sure. I think that sorbet is a really big positive for big teams, especially. But I think that if I were to do a personal project, if it was just me and I was like, I want to like spin up this cool app to accomplish some project over the weekend, I want to solve some personal problem, I don't think that I would introduce it, mostly because I can just move a lot faster without it. Yeah, I think that its strength really does live inside of making well-defined boundaries and making contract level decisions and having that type of clarity for people that don't interact with that part of the code every day.
What about for like a team of 10? Let's say you join me at Podia tomorrow and we have a small team of 10-ish people. Would you recommend teams investigate at that level, or do you think that's too small where it might not be worth it?
I think it depends on the team. I think that if there is a problem that the team has and they think that sorbet might be a way to solve that problem, you should explore it. But I don't think that you should just try to introduce things just kind of without reason or without trying to say, I want to do this new thing because it solves a specific problem. If you guys are working without it and things are like going great and everybody writes perfect code, then perfect. I would say keep doing what you're doing. But I think that once you get to a size like GitHub's level and definitely below that, there is kind of a need for stuff like that. And I personally found it to be super, super helpful. And I would recommend it, but I would definitely recommend it not from an educational perspective. I would only introduce it at work if you were like, this is the problem that we're trying to solve and we think that it might help.
If you're like most devs, too much of your time gets sucked up with downtime issues, troubleshooting, and error tracking. How can you spend more time shipping code and less time putting out fires? Honeybadger is how. It's a suite of monitoring tools specifically for devs. It's the only system that combines error monitoring, uptime monitoring, and cron and heartbeat monitoring into a clean, fast interface. You won't know if Honeybadger will really save you time and trouble until you see how it works in your toolchain. With two lines of code and 5 minutes, you can see for yourself. Honeybadger automatically hooks into popular web frameworks, job systems, authentication libraries, and front-end JavaScript. Imagine fixing errors before your users can even report them. 5 minutes of your time with the free trial is all it takes to see if it will work for you. It just might be the best 5 minutes you've spent in a while. Check out honeybadger.io.
In our little remaining time, I would like to touch a little bit on Copilot. So we won't spend the whole episode talking about it, but it is a really cool feature that you're a part of. What's the thing you're most proud of that you've helped implement inside of it?
One of the things that I've been doing lately, I don't think I can go into a lot of the specifics about the data and stuff, but there are lots of different clients of this API that my team owns. And requests could be coming from lots of different places, but there's differing levels of information that we get from some of those clients right now. And one of the things that I've done is marry up the information that we have, regardless of the client that is sending us information. They might be doing different types of auth or whatever. So now we're able to get rid of lots of checks that are like, if it's this type of auth, we have this set of assumptions that we kind of have to work on. And if we have this type of auth, we know that we're guaranteed to have this value all the time. So now in the rest of the project, we're able to get rid of lots of conditional checks around whether or not a value is present. Yeah, it makes a lot of stuff much simpler, especially for things whether it's like feature flag checks based on certain values or whatever. Now everything is just kind of consistent and you can kind of do everything the same way. So externally, there's not really a whole lot of changes that end users are going to see. But from like a developer perspective and somebody working on my team, I hope that my teammates would say that's been like a really positive change and it reduces the cognitive load a lot around introducing certain types of changes.
Yeah, just so people listening might not have ever used Copilot outside of VS Code, but you can use it in NVIM. You can use it through the CLI. There's Copilot features built into GitHub itself and the PR stuff. There's GitHub apps, I'm assuming, that might be able to interact with it. The VS Code stuff. Oh my God. Now that I'm thinking about it, that's a nightmare.
Yeah, I think that we've done a really good job at being able to onboard new pieces of functionality or teams or whatever to support their specific use cases. Because at the end of the day, I think that for chat, at least, a lot of it is similar in a way where you have some kind of prompt and you submit that prompt to Copilot and then it gives you some kind of response. In concept, it's having a conversation and it's reasonably straightforward. In practice, obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that. And there's plenty of other things going on behind the scenes.
If you could give one tip for using the chat more effectively, what would it be?
I think that the main tip that I would provide is to give as much context as possible. So if I ever have a question or I want to figure something out, the majority of the time that I use Copilot chat is in VS Code in the side panel. And instead of just going in there and typing, what's wrong with this code? You're going to get much better answers with the more context that you provide. So you could highlight a piece of code and use that as a snippet that you provide to Copilot and say, like, use this as a reference to what my question is. And instead, I would say this method isn't capitalizing this word and I need it to capitalize this word. Why might that be? Then it can start digging into, oh, well, like you're not using like the two uppercase method or something like that. The more context that you're able to provide, you're going to get way better answers. So that's kind of my biggest thing is whenever I see somebody complaining and saying, this answer sucks, it's like the question is only three words.
Right.
You put a lot of effort into your prompts and you're going to get higher value output from the model, I think.
I had this idea the other day. I'm actually glad I can ask you about it. So I had this brilliant idea the other day because I was watching the VS Code YouTube channel. They put out a bunch of videos on Copilot all the time. If you're looking for resources on that, go check them out. And I was listening to them explain some of the new features. So now you can use the pound sign and there's certain actions that will follow and you could use the at symbol to like invoke certain agents. And I was thinking about context and prompting and I was like, I think what would maybe really help for me would be to create basically in the temp file of my Rails app. Every time I'm working on a new project or a new PR, I can dump a bunch of context for that specific thing I'm working on into a markdown file and then provide that file to Copilot chat every time I ask it a question. So it's like all the scope and maybe certain coding practices and patterns I want to implement and stay away from and this or that, I keep these in that file and then I use that in addition to the existing context for the workspace. Smart or no?
I think that it's smart. I also don't think that it's something that doesn't exist. I think that that is a thing that does exist. So here's another funny piece of information in that I'm probably not the most expert Copilot user from an end user perspective. I know a lot about writing code for my team's piece of ownership inside of Copilot. So if I misspeak, that's why. But I'm pretty sure that there is a way that you can give more context to Copilot that's basically for every question I ask you, respond like you're
Sandy Metz.
Yeah, Sandy Metz, whatever. You're able to do stuff like that. I will have to look into if that's actually a thing. I'm pretty sure it is.
I haven't seen it. It's basically describing like the custom instructions that you can provide to ChatGPT. There's like for the duration of these instructions, you follow these things. And like for me, I put things like always output bullet points, for instance. Yeah. So I haven't seen that yet, but maybe there.
Maybe it's not. Maybe I am kind of conflating it with ChatGPT. That's possible.
Well, either way, we won't hold you to it. There's a huge disclaimer at the beginning of every episode that says we're not experts. And if you take this as expert advice, then that's your fault.
Yeah, definitely. Not an expert. I'm just the guy working on some stuff.
And you're working mostly on the back end, right?
Yeah. So it's exclusively back end.
Yeah.
I'm not working on like VS Code or any of the other clients that you had mentioned. That is definitely not me. Those are all people that are experts in their own right. I'm just working on a back-end Go service, which is definitely complicated and definitely has its own subset of problems. But yeah, lots of the user-facing features.
Julie, do you have any other questions?
I was just going to say, speaking of Copilot tips, you promised me an episode on Copilot tips. So now that it's out there publicly, maybe we'll plan on that in the near future.
Yeah, Andrew will be the new expert.
I do. I feel like I could give a conference talk on it right now.
Do it.
No.
We'll find you a conference.
If you want to find me a conference. I'm curious, what do you want to leave on our listeners as like your final impression? It doesn't have to be about anything we talked about. What's one thing that you want to say to maybe the newer Rubyists, newer Rails developers who are listening?
Yeah, I think that maybe the main thing that I would say is, at least from my perspective, I think that people should be mindful of the things that they want to learn or invest time into. In software development, there are 800 million bazillion concepts that you could dig into. And for every little package that you import and it helps you a little bit along in your project, behind the scenes, there is a team of people that have spent years on developing something. You can invest all of your time into a tiny little feature and become an expert in that feature, but you will never get that time back. So I think that it's really important for people to decide with intention what they want to invest their learning time into. And as long as there's a reason for it and you can get behind that, that's awesome. That's kind of my big thing is protect your time and
make sure that when you want to learn something new, you at least know why.
Do you think people should still learn Ruby on Rails in 2024?
100%. It's still relevant. People are still making lots of new apps. I saw a joke on Twitter a little while ago that was like, Rails is only good for prototyping really successful projects, where it was just like, Hulu used to be on Rails, GitHub is on Rails, GitLab is on Rails. There's tons of projects that people are able to start really quickly and get to profitability. And I think that Rails is the best at that. I think people should still totally learn it. But if it's going to be a first language or whatever, I think that my recommendation is learn the thing that is going to keep you interested. Because once you pick up one language or framework or whatever, you can shift into something else and become productive. But I think it's the first hurdle is getting confident and consistent and learning something the first time.
Very cool. Well, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Yeah. So I'm at Ryan James Caldwell on GitHub. It's Ryan Caldwell with three L's on the end on Twitter. And that's kind of where I hang out.
We will put links to that in the show notes. Ryan, really appreciate your time.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Well, to the rest of you, we will see you back when we see you. Bye.